Ignite Foundation and the State of Minnesota, online at ampers.org.
I'm Chantel Sings. This week, we continue the coverage of the escalation of Operation Metro Surge in the Twin Cities. The Secretary of Homeland Security says the Trump administration is sending hundreds more immigration and federal agents, even after an ICE agent shot and killed Renee Good during an immigration raid in South Minneapolis. City and state officials say ICE's presence in the Twin Cities has disrupted daily life and is creating an atmosphere of fear among residents in general, and are calling for ICE to leave the state. The operation has led to detention of hundreds of immigrants and protesters and daily public protests and conflicts. We begin the program with reactions from community members about Operation Metro Surge, the killing of Renee Good, and what they expect might come next. Then, we look at how hazardous road conditions are affecting drivers, along with tips on how to stay safe on winter roads. And we conclude with ways to protect yourself and your health when clearing your sidewalks and driveways. But first, here are some of the stories that made the headlines this week. The Hennepin County Attorney's Office and the Minnesota Attorney General's Office are collecting and preserving evidence for their investigation into the killing of Renee Good in Minneapolis. The move follows the FBI's decision to withdraw its cooperation agreement with the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The Hennepin County attorney said she's been meeting with law enforcement and community leaders to support a thorough and transparent investigation.
So let me be clear here. We do have jurisdiction to make this decision that happened in this case where her life was taken in Hennepin County. It does not matter that it was a federal law enforcement agent.
Residents can submit photos or videos through an online portal on the Hennepin County Attorney's website and social media pages. Meanwhile, the Federal Department of Justice says it will not pursue a criminal civil rights case against the ICE agent who shot Renee Good. But the FBI is still investigating the killing. In other news, Minnesota's Attorney General is trying to get ICE and other federal agents out of our state, but has already faced his first setback. He filed a federal lawsuit to stop what he calls an unconstitutional surge of federal agents into Minnesota.
We allege that the obvious targeting of Minnesota for our diversity, for our democracy, and our differences of opinion with the federal government is a violation of the Constitution and of federal law. We allege that the surge's reckless impact on our schools, on our local law enforcement, is a violation of the 10th Amendment and the sovereign laws and powers of the Constitution grants to states.
State and city officials say the thousands of armed and masked federal agents are carrying out militarized raids, illegal stops, and excessive force arrests under the banner of immigration enforcement. The lawsuit asks the court to end the operation and prevent federal agents from targeting protesters, bystanders, and people at schools, churches, and hospitals. But a court ruled against the state's request to stop the operation immediately, instead giving the federal government more time to respond. The court may rule later this month after hearing more from both sides. You're listening to North Star Stories. I'm Chantel Sings. In today's main story, just blocks from George Floyd Square in Minneapolis, a chaotic confrontation between federal agents and protesters ended with an ICE officer shooting and killing a local woman. The federal officer's use of fatal force ignited a fierce debate over the right to protest versus the tactics federal officers are using and even the justification for their presence. Up next, Catherine DeSalle looks at the deeply polarizing aftermath and why it's prompting calls for peaceful protests.
Say her name! Renee Good!
In Minneapolis, just blocks away from where George Floyd was murdered in the summer of 2020, thousands of people gathered to honor the life of Renee Good, a 37-year-old woman who was shot and killed by an Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, agent.
Renee cared for the people in this city, and that is more than any ICE agent or any police officer could say.
That was Noah, an organizer with Twin Cities Coalition for Justice, one of many who spoke at several vigils honoring Renee Good. For their protection, we are using first names only for our sources in this report. While Noah praised Good for her bravery, the narrative of how and why Renee Good died depends entirely on who you ask. Video of the shooting shows her car stopped perpendicular on the street, blocking traffic near an ongoing ICE operation. Officers shouted obscenities at Good, demanding she get out of the car. And as she attempted to drive away, a federal agent shot and killed her. Prompting a debate and divide in the community. Was she driving away from or directly at an officer? On social media, President Trump called Good a professional agitator, claiming she viciously ran over the agent. In a press conference, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem went further.
She attempted to run an law enforcement officer over. This appears as an attempt to kill or to cause bodily harm to agents, an act of domestic terrorism.
But at the vigil, that story sounded very different.
And now we're seeing lies from the federal administration calling her a domestic terrorist. That's a lie. She showed up to watch the terrorists.
Others at the vigil, like Gar, a Minneapolis resident, questioned how we as a community can stop tragedies like this from happening.
There is a human and they had a gun and they decided to pull the trigger. And why did they decide to do that? Nobody wants to pull the trigger on someone. Even these ICE agents are human and they have this thing that they're trying to do. And how can we be there to be like, you just don't do that?
ICE agents are creating a lot of fear for many Minnesotans. Mira is a community organizer with MIRAC, Minnesota Immigrant Rights Action Committee, a volunteer organization that is fighting to end immigration raids.
People have been very afraid to even leave their houses at all or to take their kids to school, or children are afraid that when they get home from school, their parents are going to be gone.
Mira hopes the death of Renee Good empowers community members to stand up to ICE.
Instead of letting the incident scare people into submission or staying home and not taking action, I'm hoping people see how necessary it is for all of us to be in the streets to show that the power of the people is stronger than the people in power.
And this is where the division lies. While Mira and Gar see a community protecting others and defending itself, other Minnesotans, like David, argue that interfering with federal agents creates a dangerous and unpredictable environment.
I'm all for protests.
I think this country's built on it. But the minute that you interfere with a police action, the protester is elevating the situation past where it needs to be. It escalates the problem to a safety issue.
For years, the conversation about fear and lethal force from law enforcement has centered rightfully on the dangers facing Black and Brown neighbors. But as David suggests, Renee Good may have been relying on a protection that is no longer there.
She thought they're just going to allow me to drive away because I'm a white woman. That's how I feel that her thought process was. And the minute that her vehicle got too close, unfortunately, all bets were off at that point because he has a family too, just like she did.
After learning about the death of Renee Good, Dan, a retiree who has been trained to be a legal observer, went to the scene of the shooting to document what ICE agents were doing. He ended up caught in a cloud of tear gas, a shock for a man who peacefully protested the Vietnam War.
I was shouting, get out of Minnesota, get out of Minneapolis. Some people were throwing snowballs and we were cautioning them, don't, please don't, just we're here to witness what's going on. We're not here to provoke. And then the tear gas got to me. Tear gas was everywhere. I just couldn't see and fell over.
Despite this incident, Dan still plans to attend protests and be a legal observer and asks others to do so. Governor Walz is also encouraging Minnesotans to exercise their right to protest, but to remain peaceful. Walz and others say federal agents are using strong intimidation tactics, hoping to spark violence to justify sending even more agents.
And so to Minnesotans, don't take the bait. Do not allow them to lie about the security and the decency of this state. Let's make sure we protect our neighbors. I encourage you to use your First Amendment rights and all of your constitutional rights, but do so in a peaceful manner.
Although Minnesotans may not agree on how or whom to protest, most Minnesotans agree that we are divided and that it's time to come together. Gar says,
I truly believe that we're at an opportunity as humanity basically move to the next level, realizing that we're just humans here.
David asks,
can we please just go back to common sense and stop the dangerous rhetoric from everybody, from the president to the mayor to the governor, to just everybody take a deep breath, start talking to one another?
And Dan says,
several of my friends and acquaintances have said, Dan, you're so brave. And other ones say, Dan, how dumb? Why did you go? And they're both right. But even if you're not personally affected, we all are together when we all really act together.
For North Star Stories, I'm Catherine DeSalle.
Welcome back to North Star Stories. I'm Chantel Sings, and I'm joined by former Chief of Minneapolis Police Department, Madaria Arredondo, who served from 2017 to 2022. He's the first Black chief of the Minneapolis Police Department and was chief of police during the high-profile murder of George Floyd, as we all know. Chief Arredondo, welcome to North Star Stories. How are you?
Thank you, Ms. Chantel. It's always a pleasure to see you, to be in space with you.
Thank you. So just a few questions for you. We know that it's a very tough time here in Minnesota. From a policing perspective, what should officers be trained to do when protesters are loud, they're recording them, or questioning their actions?
There was a lot that came out after Mr. Floyd was murdered, and certainly Minneapolis police went into having a revamp of a lot of their trainings and protocols specifically related to how to engage with community members during protests. And one of those things, and it's going to be principal and paramount even to this day, is de-escalation. The other thing that police officers are doing is we have it in our policy, reminding police officers that people do have a First Amendment right to use their cell phones, to use cameras, to video and record those engagements.
How do you balance, though, officers' safety with First Amendment rights in that moment?
Policies are very clear. People will have the right to protest. People will have the right to use their voice. We know that sometimes these demonstrations, people are coming there from all different spaces. People may be there in a very calm way. People may be very angry. Officers can expect to hear some of that anger. But it's so key and important that officers stay calm, that they use their de-escalation techniques. Most importantly, Ms. Chantel, that they stay professional. But we know sometimes just having that uniform can be a focus of what that anger is all about. I think it's critically important, certainly for Minneapolis, that supervisors are there at the scene. If they start to see tensions creating, or if they start to perhaps see an officer go below that professionalism, to get them off of that line. The key, though, is to make sure that the officers themselves do not become a focal point of any sort of anger or frustration for those demonstrating.
For sure. You mentioned tension. And what does best practice look like for crowd management and use of force? And where do you think agencies most often fall short?
Part of it is to make sure that officers, first and foremost, have an idea of what the situation is, where they're at. You know, sometimes demonstrations look a little bit differently. You know, if it's outside of a building, whether it's folks and it's static, or whether those are folks, hundreds or thousands of folks marching through, let's say, for example, Lake Street. All of that's going to be very dependent upon how police manage that. But one of the things that I always have found useful was, and I talk about this a lot, you know, building relationships in the quiet moments, getting to know local leaders, getting to know local activists before those situations occur, so that when there are these large convenings, you know, you have someone that you can communicate with. Trying to keep that dialogue open, I think, is very important for police leaders who are going to be out there when these demonstrations occur.
If you were still chief, what would you say to the public right now that's just absolutely outraged by the actions of federal agents?
The first thing I would say, Ms. Chantel, is that I know that our city's hurting. There is a lot of pain still left. While it has been 5.5 years since Mr. Floyd was murdered, for many it seems like yesterday. Certainly the tragic death of Ms. Good seems like it has ripped off a Band-Aid from old wounds. So that's real. So the first thing is just acknowledging that it is real. The other thing I would also say, in that pain, in that grief, for many in that trauma, I would also say, I want to make sure that I'm doing all that I can not to make it worse in that sense. You know, I lived through, as well as you did, many of your listeners, we saw the pain after May 25th, 2020. We saw what it looked like to try to, you know, rebuild our city, to rebuild hope. And so in some ways, it seems very similar to that. But I will continue to have hope. The other thing I would say this, and I said this about Mr. Floyd back then, and I think it's true for Ms. Good here. At the end of the day, they both deserve justice. They both deserve due process. They both deserve a fair and impartial investigation.
Chief Arredondo, always a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Ms. Chantel, and for your listeners. Thank you.
After the break, as more winter weather is on the forecast, we take a look at how to stay safe on the state roads. This is North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, produced by Ampers, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota. We'll be right back.
Tune in to hear Minnesota's statewide newscast,
North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live.
Each week, we bring you stories and perspectives from across the state's diverse communities.
North Star Stories amplifies voices too often missing from our state's news.
Black, Indigenous, and communities of color, people living with disabilities, elders, LGBTQIA Two-Spirit residents, and those in greater Minnesota.
Find North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live in your station schedule at ampers.org and wherever you get your podcasts.
Produced by Ampers, Diverse Radio for Minnesota's communities.
You are listening to North Star Stories. I'm Chantel Sings. A nonpartisan audit has uncovered even more concerns about the misuse of state funds. The Office of the Legislative Auditor, or OLA, has released a new report that found widespread failures in how the Department of Human Services Behavioral Health Administration manages grant programs for mental health and substance use disorder services. The report says the agency failed to follow most state requirements, lacked basic financial controls, and even created and backdated documents after the audit began. One of the auditors expressed shock presenting the report to the state legislator.
Frankly, in the 27 plus years I've been with OLA, I have never seen this before. I will say we have had suspicions periodically, but we have never been able to prove it, to document it. And we did in this case. And it's very troubling.
Between 2022 and 2024, the administration distributed more than $425 million to 830 grantees. But auditors found missing progress reports, incomplete financial records, and missing documentation for many required site visits. Minnesota is about to lose its last hometown airline. Allegiant and Sun Country Airlines have announced a merger agreement that will combine the two carriers. Under the deal, Allegiant will acquire Sun Country in a cash and stock transaction valued at about $1.5 billion. Sun Country Airlines was founded in 1982 by a small group of former Braniff International Airways pilots and flight attendants. The airline employs about 3,000 workers, primarily based in the Twin Cities. Executives from both airlines say the merger will expand service to more vacation destinations in the U.S. and abroad while keeping a focus on affordable travel. Next, with winter in full force, driving has become trickier than ever. The freezing and thawing has created especially icy streets in some parts of the state. Other areas have dealt with heavy snow. Reporter Jamad Jama talks with drivers and officials about how to stay safe on the roads this winter.
From the Twin Cities to greater Minnesota, drivers are once again figuring out how to handle winter roads safely.
Winter kind of came early this year, and we've already had a significant amount of snow compared to the previous years. But it seems like every year we need to kind of relearn how to drive in the wintertime.
That's Lieutenant Michael Lee with the Minnesota State Patrol. When it comes to navigating the roads, his advice comes down to planning ahead.
Some of the basic reminders that we tell people is just to be prepared. If you know a storm's coming or the roads are going to be potentially bad, we're asking people just to delay your travel plans, just wait a little bit until the road conditions get better.
And if you find yourself on the roads when conditions are tough, here's what he suggests.
If you are out on the roads, people should be really cautious, slow down, make sure you can keep control your vehicle at all times. Wear your seatbelt, keep your headlights on.
Winter roads can be really tricky, especially when it comes to speed and busy roads.
Of course, each crash and incident is different, but generally people are just driving too fast for conditions. A lot of it too is just the unknown, what's going on in the road and the traffic around you, that they might not be able to react to it quickly. And very easy way to combat it by slowing down.
Outside the Twin Cities, in more rural areas, winter driving can look different.
Compared to the metro, greater Minnesota has generally less traffic traveling those roadways. So with that, there might be less road maintenance vehicles there, like DOT or county workers plowing and salting. So northwest Minnesota, there were a significant amount of winds. So it's whiteout conditions. There's just a lot more of that in greater Minnesota.
And for those who drive every day, winter requires a different kind of focus.
My name is Veronica Nieto. I currently drive for Metro Micro. We are a third party to Metropolitan Council. So my service is front door service to pick up and drop off. The Metro Micro buses, they seat up to, with myself included, 9 passengers, and it fits 2 regular size wheelchairs.
Veronica's responsible for getting people where they need to go safely, no matter the weather or the time of day.
Metro Micro is actually a public service that anyone can use. We cater to all kinds of people, kids that are going to school, the elderly. With winter, I can only imagine what I'm going to run into.
Winter doesn't just change the roads. It changes the way she goes about her day.
I work Monday through Friday. Currently, because of the snowfall, we have to take our time getting there. So mentally, I prepare myself as I'm going to work. Expect the unexpected, be on guard.
And when you're driving people who are counting on you, that means paying attention to every move on the road.
With the conditions and, you know, with the fog that we've had lately, your reaction and ability to stop is shortened by a lot.
And from Veronica's experience, there's a couple things every driver should keep in mind, especially during winter.
Give yourself enough room. I think that's the major one. I just think everyone on the road can really appreciate giving yourself that extra room just because of the unforeseen. Rushing will get you nowhere.
But regardless of where you are in the state, the American Automobile Association, also known as AAA, is one of the statewide agencies helping people get back on the roads. Brenna Knapp leads public affairs for AAA in the state of Minnesota.
If you do find yourself on the side of the road or needing assistance in a more rural area, we have a large network of partners that can get to you from your area, and they're local to the place that you'll be calling from.
We do community events, we do media informational outreach to folks, and really just promoting traffic safety throughout the state.
And the demands of the job shift with the seasons.
We certainly see a pickup in our roadside assistance, especially in the winter here in Minnesota. We do, battery changes, we help people who are stuck on the side of the road.
And certain winter conditions, like slick roads or even black ice, lead to an uptick in calls for AAA.
You know, if we experience a winter weather event that leads to black ice or icy road conditions, we'll certainly see an uptick in calls for our tow drivers. If you do find yourself on the side of the road, we really do recommend that you stay in the car, stay calm. If you have AAA, give them a call or give any first responder a call.
And remembering to take your time can make all the difference when it comes to staying safe.
I know a lot of us are super busy, and it can be easy to jump in the car, and especially if it's a normal destination for you, to just drive on autopilot. But I really encourage you, in any sort of winter conditions, to take everything slowly and add a little extra care and add a little extra space between you and the person in front of you, and you're going to be golden.
Staying safe while driving in winter isn't just about snow or ice. It comes down to paying attention, being prepared, and looking out for other drivers. Whether you're in the cities or greater Minnesota, you can check out the latest road conditions on 511mn.org. For North Star Stories, I'm Jama Jama.
In our final story today, snow shoveling. It's so common that many don't realize just how dangerous it can be. Jose Osoria talks with medical professionals about steps you can take to stay safe.
It's your responsibility to clear sidewalks in front of your home or business.
So we've all heard these announcements.
Sure, it's the law, but it's also the right thing to do for your neighborhood.
But shoveling snow is not as straightforward as it might seem.
It's actually the so-called perfect storm, unfortunately, for the heart.
Dr. Courtney Jordan Beckler is a preventative cardiologist. She describes the intense strain on the body that comes with shoveling snow.
When we lift snow, it puts an extra amount of effort on the heart. It makes our heart rate increase. It makes our blood pressure increase.
But it's not just the workout that's causing the stress on your body.
The cold weather causes our arteries to constrict and get much smaller,
turning a routine chore into a potentially fatal experience if you're at risk or if specific precautions are not followed.
Emergency. What's the location?
Roddy Hood is the operations and marketing manager for Snow Scholars, a snow shoveling service that hires college students in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and other locations throughout the country.
Health is wealth. And if you need to spend a little bit of extra money on a service, and if that's going to keep you, you know, safe and healthy, by all means do so.
Roddy Hood views the work that Snow Scholars provide as a public service for the community.
That's why we service so many, you know, elders within the community, is because they can't do it themselves, because they'll fall. They'll end up hurting themselves, or the snow is so heavy.
Yet even fit college students need to be very cautious when they're out there working in the elements.
Even, you know, for young people like us, it's demanding, it's physical, it's labor. Just making sure you know yourself. When you're doing that for anywhere between 6 hours and above, it's a lot.
The American Journal of Emergency Medicine published a research study showing that shoveling snow sends on average over 11,000 adults to the emergency room each year. Dr. Beckler points out that even otherwise in-shape people need to listen to their body.
You don't get on the treadmill and go to an all-out sprint on a big incline, right? You want to start things slowly, see how you feel, and progress as you feel comfortable. It's an exercise.
She also points out some of the warning signs you should pay close attention to if you find yourself out there doing heavy shoveling.
Difficulty breathing, shortness of breath, a racing heart rate, chest pressure or chest discomfort. All of those types of things can be concerns from the heart.
But if you have to be out there and you are at risk, Dr. Beckler says there is an approach.
If possible, asking somebody else, a neighbor, a friend, to help you out is a great way to go. But if you absolutely have to do it, doing small amounts of snow and pushing it rather than lifting it is really important.
Roddy Hood says there's an advice he gives to Minnesotans he consults with.
Being smart, you know, especially when you come from or grown up in a state like Minnesota, we've been around the snow for forever. Being mindful of your environment, knowing the conditions, making sure that you've taken the correct preparation.
The American Heart Association lists some helpful tips to protect yourself while shoveling. Dress for the weather, stay hydrated, warm up before shoveling, do not overexert yourself, listen to your body, and watch out for warning signs. For North Star Stories, I'm Jose Osoria.
This is all the time we have for today's program. If you missed any part of today's newscast, you can find this and past episodes at ampers.org or listen to the podcast wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week with more stories and voices from the North Star State.
North Star Stories is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ampers.org.
Well, that's a pretty noise.
Right? It's one of my favorite springtime calls. It's the Northern Cardinal. I always think that they sound a little bit like car alarms with that beep, 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 wee, wee.
Yeah.
It reminds me. Cardinals, car alarms.
Yeah, good to remember. It reminds me of, I had this like plastic bird whistle when I was little that you'd put water in it and then you'd blow and it would make like a little chirpy sound. It reminds me of that.
I like that. Mm-hmm. This is the Season Watch podcast. I am Charlie Mitchell. That is Jennifer Barr. And we're here to talk about nature and all the delight and joy and discovery we can find out there.
Yeah.
How are you doing this week, Jennifer?
I'm okay. It's January and people think, oh, not much happens in January. But I'm finding a lot does, both in nature and I do a lot of event stuff for KAXE, and there's a lot of events going on too. Lots of winter things happening where people want to get outside. So it's good.
Yeah, absolutely. What are you looking forward to events wise?
Well, KABXE is doing Ski Palooza a week from Saturday, January 24th, Three Island Park in Bemidji, with like fat tire biking, cross country skiing, whatever people want to do, snowshoeing. And there's like a warming house there. And then people can bring snacks. People can bring instruments if they want to just like do musical jams. So like lots of fun stuff that day. It's from noon to 3, January 24th at Three Island Park in Bemidji. Ski Palooza.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Now on the complete opposite end of the state, we have a partnering school in Caledonia. And so I wanted to listen in on their report from this week. So I'm guessing it sounds a little bit different from what people up in Bemidji are experiencing.
We have another report coming up. This one from Dan Winkler's class at Caledonia High School in Houston County.
Hi, this is Keontae Jonah Cooper reporting from Caledonia High School, location Houston County, Minnesota, on January 9th, 2026. We noticed most of the snow has melted after we received 7/8 of an inch of rain, which is the most rain on record in January.
Red, unk, care, half, fear, reef.
Birds have been active at feeders. Black capped chickadees are beginning to sing. Deer have been shedding their antlers. Baltic kingfishers has been staying close to their open water at Beaver Creek. Wild turkeys have been walking at ridgetops in search of acorns. And the end of December brought blizzard conditions. This has been Keontae, Jonah, and Cooper reporting from Caledonia High School. And never stop questioning.
Sounds a little bit different down there than what you might be finding up in Bemidji.
Yeah, a little bit. Though that's the far southeastern corner of the state.
Yes, far southeastern. And okay. Bemidji is, you know, kind of central and
northwestern,
western, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit different. I'm guessing there aren't many belted kingfishers up there right now.
Probably not.
Now, Jennifer, do you have a bird feeder?
I don't have a bird feeder currently. I have in the past. I've had like those like little kind of suet things that have seed like embedded in them before. And I think I should get something because I've got some bushes just right outside my kitchen window and living room windows that I think would be fun to get birds at. And I think my cats would like it. They could just look from the inside and not have to be, you know, mean outdoor cats.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's let them enjoy it from between, you know, a pane of glass. We got to hear from non-game wildlife biologist Pam Perry this week, who was talking a bit about what she feeds her winter birds.
This morning, I did want to talk about winter bird feeding. And, you know, I've done this before, but I think it's always good to just go back over it because it's January and we're all kind of, you know, like I said, it's kind of that time of year. And, you know, I have bird feeders. I love watching my feeders. Right now, with colder weather, peanuts and suet, I would say, are the two biggies. I've always had people asking me, well, if you're only going to feed one thing, what do you feed? Well, and I'd always say sunflower. But, you know, in the winter, the high energy foods are really important. And I can fill my peanut feeder and it's pretty much gone, emptied in a day. That's how much they want that. And I am putting out sunflower and other things.
But
more different things you put out, the more variety of birds you're going to get.
For sure, yes.
I mean, that's just kind of the way it is.
Birds?
Oh, everybody. Almost everybody.
Really?
Definitely the woodpeckers.
I'm not surprised chickadees will eat them?
Oh, yeah. Nuthatches.
They pick them up. Yeah. Do they take them and pick them, or do they just pick them apart there? Or I've never fed peanuts.
Well, chickadees grab them and take them away for the most part. Yeah. Or they make them a piece a little smaller.
That's got to be a...
But the woodpeckers are all over it. And then, unfortunately, the blue jays.
You know.
And I love blue jays. But, you know, they can also go through them. But so I also put out a millet mix. And I wanted to mention that because I have juncos. And, John, I would expect you don't have juncos.
I do not. Yeah.
You know, and I have maybe half a dozen or more that are still here, and I'm kind of on the northern edge of where they're going to winter. And juncos, because they're in the sparrow family, millet, crack corn, you know, which are very cheap things to buy, you know, they really like those.
Yeah.
And those are things, I have a friend that says, I don't feed millet because nothing eats it. I said, oh yeah, there's certain things that eat it. And you have to put out the food that for the things you want to attract or the things that you already have. And certainly millet, when we get towards spring for mourning doves and sparrows and things like that.
Yeah.
But I put out millet and crack corn right now because of the juncos. And they've stayed this long. I expect they're going to keep staying through the whole winter.
Yeah. I had one year, I had a group, four or five, that lived under my deck. Mm-hmm. And I put out millet until they left, and they didn't leave until mid-January about this time, and then I guess it just got more than they could stand, even though I was providing them with plenty of food, and I was actually drizzling the millet down through the gaps between the deck boards so that they could.
Really?
Oh yes. Not a, I threw it out on the ground next to the feeder, but I was also drizzling it through the cracks because I knew they were living under there. And I thought, well, you know, you don't have to go far. You can just wander around down there and get it.
So, yeah, and I think they're going under my deck, too, as well.
A little protection.
Yeah, it's warmer there.
I suspect.
They can just get overnight warmer. So what you put out matters. I also put out golden safflower.
Ooh.
Yeah. Now, safflower can come in white or golden. And this is for the cardinals. That is one of their favorite foods. And the golden has a little more fat content or something to it. I don't know. I looked into it once and I went, oh, yeah, I'll get this. And now whatever it was. But I have cardinals all year round. They nest right here. And in the winter, of course, I see cardinals every day. They're here. And so they'll eat sunflower, too. They'll eat, you know, a variety of things. But they really like safflower.
Now
and, of course, I get these things at our local bird store here in Brainerd.
Yeah.
Who is also a KXE supporter.
Yep. Yep. We've had them on many times. I have white safflower that my sister was going to be leaving town for the winter, so she gave me her supply. And white safflower was among them. And I put it out, and it was disappearing, but I didn't see the birds like flocking to it, and I do not have cardinals.
Well,
I've seen them once or twice during the year when they kind of come by. I suppose they hear the ruckus of the other birds and they're like, what's going on here? But for some reason, they're not attracted to my place as a place to hang out.
Another thing I wanted to mention is that I used to feed thistle a fair amount, Niger thistle. And then I always found that the birds only liked it for so long, and then it gets stale or something, and they don't like it. And I was always throwing it out. And I've pretty much switched to sunflower chips. And I put the broken up sunflower chips into a feeder, and that is the main thing that my finches go to. And I will say that all I've got for finches this year so far are goldfinches. I had a couple pine siskins early and then they left. I saw a couple purple finches earlier. They're gone. All I have right now are goldfinches, but I am hoping to get more. And so I keep putting my sunflower chip feeder out, hoping for more finches.
That's a good idea. I've had the same experience with Niger, and I still have some Niger, and it's out there, but I don't have any goldfinches, I don't have any redpolls, no pine siskins, which I would have expected this year, but no. I have talked to people who use sunflower chips, And that's a great idea. I could put those in the same tube feeders and
it's the same tube feeder because they're small enough, and the finches have small enough bills that they can pick them out.
Yep.
But my goldfinches really like that, and it's pretty much as soon as I fill that feeder and put it out, they're there. So,
by the way, Little Falls Phenology Group reports purple finches there, so you're not far. They're near you. Maybe when the word gets out that you've got sunflower chips, they'll move north.
Maybe they will. And I did have I had one house finch that showed up, and house finches overwinter in Brainerd, in town, at the Arboretum and around. But I had one that showed up a couple times, but it's been pretty slow for finches, surprisingly slow, I think.
By my count, I think Pam Perry has at least 5 separate bird feeders. I think safflower, suet, peanuts, millet and cracked corn, which might end up going on the ground, I'm not sure, and then sunflower chips. And I would assume she has black oil sunflower seeds, because that's kind of a standard. Black oil sunflower seeds, the ones, you know, with the shells, that they are really hard on the plants underneath the feeder. And I don't know whether it's because all the squirrels and mice and stuff come by and are rummaging around for seeds and they just kind of eat off or trample down all the plants underneath. But yeah, that being said, they do lure in so many great birds. Mm-hmm. I'm still feeding black oil sunflower seeds and enjoying it. And suet. But I've got a lot of work to do to catch up to Pam Perry's feeding station there.
I think so. I think we all do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so nice to live in a place where I can put out a bird feeder now. You know, living in apartments and stuff. Yeah, being able to feed birds and watch them so close to your house is a bit of a privilege. And it's really nice to be able to have that back in my life again.
Yeah, we've been watching the birds. Our general manager, Sarah Bignall, has a suction cup bird feeder on her window. And mostly she's been getting a squirrel who is being quite the little acrobat on this feeder.
Yes.
We get chickadees and nuthatches come too, but the squirrel, we were watching him yesterday. I'm like, you got to move that thing higher. She's got it about maybe 2 feet off the ledge of the window, and it can jump up there. And it was hanging upside down from it.
That's amazing. We have both our suet and our black oil sunflower seed feeders are, they're called like squirrel buster or something. But they're on little springs, so if anything too heavy gets on it, it like pulls it down so you can't get at the seeds. And it is amazing. I have not seen a squirrel manage to break the system yet, but they are very persistent. Yeah, they're incredibly persistent. It's mostly the gray squirrels. The red squirrels I don't see trying to break into the feeders as much. They can put down a lot of seed
compared
to the birds.
Yes.
And at night we have flying squirrels coming to the feeder, and they aren't heavy enough to like set off the spring thing.
Okay.
So they do fill up their little cheek pouches. Actually, they're more like, I don't know, throat pouches?
Yeah.
It's pretty impressive, but I don't mind seeing them because they're so cool, and I like watching them fly in, and they're adorable. I know Heidi disagrees with me because they're pests and live in people's attics, but I love them.
Yeah.
Speaking of, you know, backyard critters, we got to hear from Don Latimer about a visit to his backyard this week.
My daughter and grandson are in town, and yesterday morning, just on demand, I wish, a coyote walked through the front yard. And my daughter was by the window, and she goes, "There's a coyote in our yard." And we all flocked to the window. My grandson got to see a coyote out in the wild right in the front yard. And, of course, the dog saw it, and then things got a little, they tended a little toward the mayhem end of things, but we kept them in the house, and the coyote was sort of unimpressed with their barking. I know coyotes are smart as the dickens, and I suspect that this guy was like, whatever, you go ahead and bark. I feel confident and safe.
It's amazing how the critters appear, like, sometimes at the perfect time.
How fun for his grandson
to get to see him.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Also, it was very much a tangent, but what did he just say? It was something, what in the Dickens?
Mm-hmm.
What are the Dickens? Yeah. Where does that come from?
Does it come from Charles Dickens?
Okay, that's a good idea.
I don't know.
It right now.
Have you ever heard like someone call a kid that you're being a Dickens?
No.
My mom used to say that, like, if you were being kind of, you know, bratty or acting up a little bit, you were being a Dickens.
Okay, so I'm finding word historians suggest that Dickens is a euphemism for the beast or the devil.
Oh.
Because it sounds like the once common alternative of devilkins.
Ah.
Fascinating. What in the devilkins? It sounds like something I need to start saying.
But yeah, it's always so fun when unexpected animals, especially ones you don't see very often, just like show up and you see them from your house.
Marshall Helmberger from the Timberjay got a really, really cool sighting of a lynx last week.
Yeah, for several days too, it sounded like.
Mm-hmm. A whole week. I'm so jealous.
Yeah. You can see his photos of that and I think a video too at timberjay.com.
Yep. I've been watching that video a few times, just feeling so jealous.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what he had to say about it.
Well, I have another question. I need to know the story behind this picture of a lynx with its tongue hanging out on your website. It's attributed to you, so you saw this lynx.
I took that photo, as a matter of fact. We had one of the most kind of fun experiences in the 40 plus years we've lived up here. And we had a Canada lynx that showed up, I think it was December 29th, and he stayed in our yard for a week. I had probably two or three weeks before that, I had, you know, found a roadkill deer along Highway 169, and I've been known to throw them in the back of the pickup and bring them home. Just to leave out for the critters. And it usually attracts something that's interesting. And but in all these years, I had never seen a Canada lynx come in. But this one showed up. And, you know, at first, when I first looked out the window, I saw this cat. I thought, oh, it must be a bobcat, because we'd had bobcats before on roadkills I'd put out. But then as soon as I picked up my binoculars and looked, it was like, oh my God, it's a lynx. You know, it had all the telltale marks, the big ear tufts, those gigantic, almost comically oversized feet, the long legs and the black tip tail. Those are all the hallmarks of a lynx. And he started in on that carcass. And for the next week, he really didn't go very far away from that carcass. I mean, he was visible almost all the time during the day, unless he had, you know, bedded down nearby. And sometimes you couldn't see him if he was in the brush, because they really do blend in. You know, the vast majority of the time, he was either eating, sitting around, or kind of milling around the carcass, guarding it. You know, or he was trying to bury it. It was fun to watch him, you know, stretching out his big paw and scrape in snow to, you know, try to cover up this carcass. Cause I'm sure he was worried, you know, that once wolves found it, his meal ticket, could be brought to a quick end. So anyway, it was fun because we had lots of folks over. People were, you know, excited at the prospect of seeing a lynx. And, of course, everybody who came over thought, oh, that lynx isn't going to be there. But, of course, it was. I mean, everybody who came over got to watch the lynx for quite a while. And it was not far from the house. I mean, I probably had the carcass out about 40 feet from the house. But, you know, when he wasn't right there, he'd be walking around the yard. He'd sit underneath the bird feeders and look. He was interested in the birds. He would walk all around the house. He was on the front porch at one point. He'd go down the front walk. He'd walk around the chicken coop. You know, he was just hanging out. And, like I said, he was there for a full week. And we were thinking it could go on for weeks, you know, because a deer carcass could probably keep a lynx going for a month, I would think. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, on day seven, that night, wolves showed up, which is what I figured would probably end this, and they you know, kind of ripped the hide off the entire deer, ate most of it, and then dragged the carcass off a ways. And I went out actually in the morning once I saw this, I went out to gather some DNA samples because the Forest Service had indicated they were interested in that because they do DNA analysis of lynx scat in the area. Oh. And so I went out to gather some of that, which was no problem. There was plenty of it there. and then as I was out there, I noticed, oh, there's the carcass not too far away. But the cat was already back on it because the wolves had moved off by this point. And, so I decided, well, I'm going to go drag that carcass back and I'll see how close I can get to this cat. And I'll tell you what, I was within 15 feet of that thing before he finally looked at me and said, nah, I think that's close enough. And he ran off a few steps, got behind some, balsam fir trees, some little ones, and then watched me while I grabbed the carcass and dragged it back to the original spot. And within 10 minutes, he was right back on it eating. So, his complete detachment from us. It was a typical cat, very aloof, you know. In fact, it was interesting to watch because, you know, it was like at some point you could easily forget you were watching a lynx versus a house cat. I mean, the way it would stretch, would get up, it's do its downward dog, it would arch its back, you know, all that, all those typical cat stretches. It would sit and lick its paws. In fact, it was very interested in the fine fur on the underside of its paws. We really got some good looks at that, you know, and that's what keeps them up is having, you know, on the snow is having that fine fur underneath there. And those feet are just comically big. So it was, you know, we really got to see all these different behaviors in the lynx. I mean, a lot of times I hear, you know, people see a lynx, it's maybe on a trail cam or it's maybe you know, crossing a road or something, but to have a whole week to be able to just observe a lynx, you know, at close range was really a unique opportunity and really, you know, kind of brought home that this is a great place to live.
Yeah. Yeah, we all need a little bit of that. Any issues with your dog or the chickens or anything?
Well, the chickens, I mean, the chicken coop I made, it's like Fort Knox. I mean, I don't think any predator could ever get in there. So I wasn't worried at all. Our dog, Loki, I mean, we did have to keep him, you know, and it turns out we really didn't have to. But, you know, we decided, you know, we'd keep him on a leash when he was in the yard. Mm-hmm. So we'd take him out in the morning to do his business. And he was wondering what's going on because normally we live out in the woods, you know, it's normally just let him out the door.
Right.
And so if we'd go to the car, we'd put him on a leash before we'd take him to the car if we were going into town or whatever. And he knew the cat was there because he'd looked out the window a few times and, you know, kind of growled and we told him no and he was okay with it. I mean, he's a live and let live kind of dog. So, I mean, he, you know, wasn't too concerned, I don't think. But at one point I took him out snowshoeing and I brought him on a leash a ways down and I took the leash off and hung it. So when I came back, I'd put him on the leash beforehand. Well, I think Loki knew what was going on. So he, when we were down there, he took off running and I realized fairly quickly that he was making a beeline back up to the house. And before the lynx had shown up, he'd like to run out and grab a few bites off of this carcass. You know, when we weren't looking. So I figured he was making a beeline. I could see his tracks in the snow. And of course, he was heading full run for the carcass. Well, as I was heading back up the hill, I suddenly heard this stifled yelp, squeal. It was a weird sound. And I thought, oh boy, something's happened. And so when I got up to the house, there was Loki on the front step, more than happy to go in. and the lynx was just sitting there on its carcass, just wondering, okay, who's going to take me on next? So we figured it was lynx 1, Loki 0 at that point.
Well, I think folks need to go to timberjay.com and just take a look at these photos. What a story. That's great.
Yeah, we also have video up, so it gives you a much better idea of just watching its movements and things like that as it's feeding and doing other things. So it's worth watching those videos as well.
Man, I am so jealous. Mm-hmm. So jealous. I live in a beautiful place that I love very much. Do we have the chance to, you know, put a deer in the back of my Honda Fit, leave it out and watch a lynx and a wolf pack show up and dine on it 40 feet out my window? No. But oh, do I want it.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
Yeah. Absolutely incredible. Yeah. Now that I think about it, I feel like the theme of this week is the joys of having windows in January.
There you go. Nice that we can
be warm inside.
Nice and warm inside, seeing things outside that are well adapted to deal with the winter for the most part. Mm-hmm. I do often, think about these critters when it does get very cold, but they can handle it. That's what they're made for, right?
Absolutely. Oh, I'm just thinking about him getting to watch the lynx clean its like big old little cat paws.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think that's my favorite thing about these wild cats is their big paws, which act like snowshoes for them. Talking about adaptations.
Yeah. Along with those long legs so that, you know, if they do break through the snowpack, they can just keep going instead of getting bogged down.
Yeah.
I also love the idea of like that lynx sitting underneath his bird feeder, watching the birds the same way your house cat watches the bird, luckily through a pane of glass in your case.
Yep.
Ugh. Yeah. Yeah. I do really recommend going to the timber chain, checking out those photos and videos. It's absolutely incredible. Ooh. Yeah. Speaking of out the window, there's a pileated woodpecker just bouncing its way up a tree outside my window right now.
Nice.
Cute. To take us out this week, we have one of those outdoor critters we just talked about. It's a red fox. And in late winter, you'll be hearing these guys calling as for mates and stuff like that. Even if you're living, you know, suburban or, you know, in an urban environment, keep an ear out, as you never know what you might hear.
Wow.
Quite the nocturnal noise.
Yeah, that would wake you up.
Absolutely.
Well, this has been the Season Watch Pod. I'm Jennifer Barr with Charlie Mitchell. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. And I wanted to say a big thanks to both Jonathan Jongsma for the recording of the Northern Cardinal and Paul Driver for the recording of the Red Fox. I got both of those off of Zeno Canto. And of course, Pam Perry, Marshall Helmberger, and John Latimer, and our friends from Caledonia High School.
Absolutely.
And of course, thanks for joining us, Jennifer.
Yes, thank you. You've been listening to the Season Watch Pod. If you want to add to our conversation, you can visit SpeakPipe. You can find that at kaxc.org. Look for Season Watch, or it's in our show notes.
This is People Powered KAXC, where you get deep dives into the nature of northern Minnesota, and sometimes you get some advice.
As the season of fall is coming to a close, please consider not getting rid of all your leaves that have fallen in your yard. Leaves that litter our yards provide hiding spaces and insulation in the winter for insects and a host of small animals. Also in the spring, leaves start breaking down, releasing nitrogen and other nutrients back into the soil, making a natural fertilizer. This concludes the Phenology Report. Have a great week and be observant.
You can learn and stay curious by listening to the brand new Season Watch podcast featuring the voices of students across the region and Charlie Mitchell and John Latimer. Go to kaxc.org or Spotify or Apple to sign up for the Season Watch podcast. Thank you.